It's Wednesday, January 21st, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org, and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers. Welcome to the middle of the week. Got an update here for you on a story we covered from last week, and that is the Dateline NBC show. Looks like they've rescheduled the Rachel Morningstar Hoffman story to be this Friday, January 23rd, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Check your local listings for the NBC station in your area for Dateline NBC. Of course, Rachel Morningstar Hoffman was the young Florida college student who was murdered by drug dealers when she was forced to go undercover for her involvement in marijuana. So, yes, tune into that story on Dateline NBC this Friday, 10 p.m. Eastern. Also, wanted to talk to you about an idea I had after speaking with Andrew Carroll from New Hampshire, and he had his protest where he admitted he was going to be possessing marijuana and had a press release and was arrested for his possession. And I got to thinking about how we could make that a larger sort of protest and still take care of the folks that worry about getting in trouble for drugs. So here's my idea. Gather a whole bunch of people at the steps of the city hall or the state capitol, you know, dozens or 100 or more if you could. And before the protest, everybody gets a quarter ounce baggie of wizard smoke. You know what I'm talking about, that fake pot stuff that you get in the back of High Times magazine, you know. And everybody gets this baggie of wizard smoke and a joint of the wizard smoke. So everybody knows they're getting a baggie that, and they know it's fake pot, and they know they're not breaking the law, right? But in the press release, point out that one dozen marijuana activists are bringing a quarter ounce of marijuana to the event and will smoke it openly at 420 to protest the marijuana laws. Point out that the dozen plan to be arrested by police for their civil disobedience. So you get the whole crowd together, you give a speech, tell everybody that a dozen brave activists are going to jail today for the simple act of smoking a joint. At 420, tell everyone to light it up. And everybody in the crowd, not just a dozen, but everybody, whips out these baggies of what's going to look like pot, but is really wizard smoke, and everybody starts puffing on joints, which aren't really joints, they're wizard smoke. Now, of course, the kicker for this would be nobody has any real pot. You just say there's some people that are going to have some real pot, but nobody actually has it. So now the police have to go through the entire crowd, and they're sifting through a whole bunch of people with wizard smoke, and they never find any real weed. Wouldn't that be a fun way to demonstrate how fruitless and ridiculous our marijuana laws are? Let me know what you think. You can send your emails to stash@normal.org, or just make a comment on the post on this idea, which I've posted at our blog, stash.normal.org. All right, now coming up on the podcast today, we've got our dose of cannabis science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. We're going to be talking about some recent studies that have claimed that heavy cannabis use by teenagers can lead to a decrease in IQ. We'll get the real data from Dr. Mitch coming up in our first interview segment. Then in our second interview segment, we'll be speaking with Aaron Smith from the Marijuana Policy Project to talk about San Bernardino County in California having potentially violated open meeting laws in trying to fight their fight against medical marijuana all the way to the Supreme Court. Aaron Smith, coming up in our second interview segment. Also, we got some pretty trippy, jammy jazz music for our musical break, and all the hemp headlines you've come to expect from your normal daily audio stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. Medical marijuana bill introduced in Minnesota. A bill to allow incurably ill patients to legally purchase marijuana is up for consideration in the Minnesota Senate. The Medical Use of Marijuana Bill, SF-97, is nearly identical to a bill that passed the Senate last year and almost passed the House. It enjoys bipartisan support this year, although last year Governor Tim Pawlenty indicated he would veto such a bill so long as law enforcement opposed it. The Medical Use of Marijuana Bill would make it legal for patients to procure up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana from a state-regulated nonprofit, only with a physician's approval and only to those patients who have registered with the state as medical marijuana users. The bill lays down harsh penalties for patients and nonprofits that dispense marijuana to individuals that aren't qualified by state registration. Two Republicans are co-authors on this year's bill. Senators Jeff Michael of Edina and Debbie Johnson of Ham Lake have signed on to support the bill, as have Senators Steve Murphy of Red Wing, Linda Higgins of Minneapolis, and John Marty of Roseville. A similar bill is expected to be introduced in the House this month and will likely have similar bipartisan support. 14 states allow the medical use of marijuana, from libertarian Alaska and Montana to liberal Vermont and California. If Minnesota passes legislation this year, it would become the second state in the Midwest to do so. Michigan passed a medical marijuana law in 2008. Public polling in Minnesota shows that legalizing medical marijuana is a popular public policy goal. Last year, a KSTP Survey USA poll showed support from 64% of Minnesotans, including 58% of Republicans. Minnesotans have favored the legalization of marijuana by more than 60% in most public opinion polls over the last 10 years. It's really good news to hear a medical marijuana bill making progress in Minnesota. Let's hope that enough people out there from Minnesota contact Governor Tim Pawlenty and tell him that this is the kind of law they want for the people of Minnesota. He needs to listen to the people and have compassion for sick and dying people instead of listening so much to law enforcement. Change.gov, Citizens Briefing Book, top all time. Third verse, same as the first. Ending marijuana prohibition. I suggest that we step back and take a non-biased, science-based approach to decide what should be done about the utter failure that we call the war on some drugs. The fact is that marijuana is much less harmful to our bodies than other legal drugs, such as tobacco and alcohol. And for the government to recognize marijuana as having medicinal properties and as a Schedule I drug having no medicinal properties is an obvious flaw in the system. We must stop imprisoning responsible adult citizens choosing to use a drug that has been mislabeled for over 70 years. from the number one issue at change.gov's Citizen Briefing Book. President Obama's change.gov website once again asked citizens for their input, and once again, we made marijuana legalization the number one issue. If a million stoners click on a website, does it make a sound? It's put up or shut up time. The wisdom to be gained from these change polls showing legalization to be a prime concern for many is not that our issue is more important than global warming, financial catastrophe, the Middle East, and so forth. It is that prohibition is such an obvious failure and legalization such an obvious windfall that Americans can't believe it is still an issue. And the key to unlocking that wisdom is knowing you're not alone in seeing the naked emperor, that what is obvious to you is obvious to others. Name any other issue that the American people support by roughly 3-to-1 margins, but no politician dares support. Yet Americans support medical marijuana by that margin. Americans believe in fine-only punishments for social marijuana by that margin. Americans support farming industrial hemp by that margin. So why is marijuana illegal? Why would politicians run from something so obviously popular? Because 3-to-1 support doesn't translate into 3-to-1 action. In a perverse way, marijuana prohibition is too flawed for people to be active about. 25 million of us smoke annually, but only 872,000 had encounters with law enforcement. In raw terms, that's only 3.5% of annual cannabis consumers who encounter the man. Then you figure how many of the 3.5% are involved in larger amounts, more often, have bad luck, are stupid, are driving, or are real criminals. And your average pot smoker thinks he's got, what, a 1 in 10,000 chance of getting busted per year? Plus, everyone who wants to smoke pot can get some. And everyone's lived under prohibition for so long that paying $45 for 3 grams of a weed seems perfectly reasonable. Then there are the dealers and growers who can accept a few people rotting in prison so long as they can continue their tax-free cash lifestyle. So time to put up. If you clicked on change.gov or change.org and you're feeling unheard, put your money where your mouse is. Donate some money to Normal and help us all be a little bit louder. Start a local chapter. Organize for the Marijuana March in May. Visit your state representative. Start an initiative if your city or state has them. Legalizing marijuana? Yes, we can. Mexican cartels run U.S. drug trade, report says. From the El Paso Times. Mexican cartels have taken over most of the drug trade in the United States and are working with 20 gangs, including the Barrio Aztecas, according to a just-released report by the National Drug Intelligence Center titled National Drug Threat Assessment 2009. It also said the cartels controlled drug distribution in most U.S. cities. 230 cities have reported a presence of the Mexican drug groups and are, quote, gaining strength in markets that they do not yet control, end quote. Mexican, Asian, Colombian, Dominican, and Colombian drug organizations work with at least 28 gangs in the United States, which insulate the drug cartel cells from law enforcement and act as retail distributors and enforcers. The gangs listed include the Barrio Azteca, Latin Kings, MS-13, Hell's Angels, Mexican Mafia, Bloods, Crips, and others. Upon learning that violent foreign criminal cartels are taking over the U.S. drug trade and extending their control through recruitment of violent local gangs to handle the retail operations, the prohibitionist's answer is to fight them harder. Never does it occur to the prohibitionist that we could take over most of the drug trade in the United States and cut 70% off the Mexican drug cartel's bottom line. People will always want to smoke marijuana. We have cannabinoid receptors in our freaking brains. The money people spend on it could buy school books for kids, but our prohibition on marijuana guarantees it buys bullets for gangsters. Maybe if we bought more kids' history textbooks, they'd grow up having learned the lessons of prohibition from 1920 to 1933.
Georgia.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson, and I need your help. Alcohol prohibition didn't work in the 20s, and marijuana prohibition isn't working today. It's time we stop arresting law-abiding citizens because they prefer marijuana over alcohol. Nearly 2,000 Americans are arrested every day on marijuana charges. We're unfairly destroying the lives and careers of hundreds of thousands of people each year simply because they smoke marijuana. These are not criminals. They're average citizens like you, good neighbors who work hard, raise families, pay taxes, and contribute to their communities. We need your help to end marijuana prohibition once and for all. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with NORML's look at cannabis science. In today's episode of Cannabis Science, Dr. Mitch Earlywine joins us to talk about the subject of teenagers and cannabis, something we get a lot of questions about. So, Dr. Mitch, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
I want to remind everyone also, if you folks listening have a question for Dr. Earlywine that we could use for this segment, you can send your questions to 420research@gmail.com. That's 420research. at gmail.com, and we reach deep into the virtual mailbag for this question that came up regarding teenagers and cannabis. Dr. Earlywine, you had somebody had emailed you about some studies about teenagers using cannabis and that effect on their IQ that you wanted to go over.
In fact, I did, and I'm really grateful to folks for emailing me on this topic. I've mentioned it a couple of times on the air and in my book, The Parent's Guide to Marijuana, that there is one study that shows heavy use in teens. This is usually the group that does 4 or 5, 6 days a week of using cannabis from about age 14 and then assessed again later on at about age 18. And these students did show a small but statistically significant decline in IQ, and it was about between 4 and 5 points, depending on how you look at it. Is that a lot? It's sort of like being, you know, you were 85th percentile and now you're sort of 76th percentile, the way these data look. So it's not an inconsequential drop. What often doesn't get played up from that same data set is that there was a set of teens who only got high once a week and their IQs were essentially the same across time in that same data set. And as one of the letter writers here emphasizes, it's really only from one laboratory. Now, you can imagine data like these are hard to gather, and this was a difficult study to do. So, you know, I can't say, yes, this is a guaranteed effect of cannabis, and it really is what the average was across a large sample. But this was enough for me to feel concerned under these circumstances. And as we've all said, you know, time and again here, this is not a rationale for keeping marijuana illegal. In fact, we have much better control over things like alcohol and tobacco because we have a tax and regulated market rather than leaving this to the underground. And as we all have said time and again, it's relatively rare for underground dealers to be carting people. It's just not to their economic advantage, whereas, you know, licensed providers of these kinds of things can lose their licenses if they, you know, don't obey legal restrictions about age, and we'd much rather see an arrangement like that.
What is it then about the use of cannabis by younger people in their teens and their developing years that would lead to something like a decrease in IQ? What is there any theory to that? Any reason why?
One theory has been that there's a change in the efficiency of the brain, and one study has shown that basically, the proportion of gray and white matter in the brain, the myelinated sort of faster neurons versus the less myelinated slower neurons, that proportion is out of whack. And one study has shown that people who were heavy users before age 18 do have a kind of deviant proportion of this white and gray matter. Nevertheless, another study looked for that exact same effect in a sample of comparable size and comparable type and did not get that same effect. So as much as it does seem to call for caution from the first study, the second study not replicating it makes me concerned that maybe this was just a statistical fluke. Again, I'm not saying that, heavy use in teens is a good idea. It's just that we don't have the evidence that that's necessarily the mechanism. The other thing that people have brought up is just that teens who tend to choose to use cannabis heavily may not be then in class learning the sorts of things that they might need to know to master certain aspects of particularly the verbal portion of the IQ test, and maybe that's where some of these deficits are showing up. So is it learning or is it an actual decrease in capacity to learn? We don't quite know. Still, this is something that I feel like we ought to make clear. As folks in medical cannabis states have been emphasizing, though, we don't want this to turn into some kind of crazy ammunition for prohibitionists. We have said this is not the situation where prohibition is going to help our cause at all. And there's been some misinformation in some of these states where people say, oh, medical cannabis is going to increase teen use. Mm. In fact, a big review Karen O'Keefe and I did just about a year ago that was also the subject of my talk at the Normal Conference that you were so kind to post on YouTube suggests that every state that has passed medical cannabis laws has either had a mild decrease in use or a leveling off of use that was comparable to, the way teens use throughout the nation. So changing medical cannabis laws does not seem to have an impact on teen use in any of the states where it's been done so far.
Did you survey the teens themselves to get any idea why medical use would reduce their want to use cannabis?
It's part of a bigger national study, so that question wasn't on there, but in the sort of informal anecdotal stories, what we're getting is essentially, yuck, this is an anti-nausea drug. Why would I be interested? That's for people with AIDS and cancer. Why would I be so interested? My concern, of course, as I mentioned at the conference, too, is that some of the prescription drug abuse is on the rise. And in all honesty, I'd much rather people were using cannabis than some of these tougher, more addictive psychostimulants that they may be, ripping off from their parents' medicine chest. So I'm a little apprehensive about the results, and it's something that we really need to get more data on.
Yeah, I guess Granny's glaucoma medicine isn't that cool amongst the kids, huh?
Exactly.
Now, we looked at some of the intellectual development with this idea of IQ and all that. How about physical or emotional development of teenagers? How is that affected by use of cannabis?
We have seen, actually in the same study that showed the deviant brain structure, slightly smaller body mass, particularly among the males who use cannabis early in life. And there are some hormonal explanations that have been offered for this. And actually some of the animal literature, particularly with rodents, suggests that maybe there's some decrease in growth hormone response and other necessary hormones for growth and puberty that are getting impeded slightly in folks who use cannabis while they're, going through adolescence. It's not the most robust finding we've ever seen, but it's certainly there. The measures of emotional development, in all honesty, to me, are kind of weak. So we are seeing some folks who use cannabis heavy, again, early in life, and show more emotional lability. They're more likely to have extreme reactions in emotions to, everyday events. But it's really a chicken and egg problem. We don't know if they were this way prior to the use of cannabis or if this is actually an impact of cannabis. And in all honesty, I feel like this may be more a sign of something that might cause someone to turn to cannabis rather than something that cannabis creates.
Mm. So as we've been discussing these issues here with the teens and cannabis, is it safe to say you don't see these kind of results when we talk about populations that began their use at an older age?
In fact, the brain structure stuff on anyone who started post age 21 is just non-existent. And the IQ changes, most of those data come from Costa Rica, where folks are literally stoned to the bone day and night. I mean, I've been really stunned at the levels of use reported in those studies, and there are no changes in IQ among those adult users across some pretty dramatic time spans. One study is over 10 years. And so, no, I can't at all say that this is the case. Now, we've discussed before, during intoxication, it's always harder to learn new material, but as far as capacity to learn or changes in brain structure, it just doesn't seem to be there. There are some studies on brain function, so basically EEG things where they put that cap on your head and all the wires are sticking out, and while you're doing certain tasks, particularly tasks that require rapid responding and responses to kind of rare stimuli, the way the brain waves work seems to be a little bit different in folks who've been high every day for 2 years or more, basically. But this is some pretty subtle effects, not the kind of thing that's very easy to detect, and certainly markedly less severe than, say, binge drinking.
Hmm. So if we were able to wave a magic wand and get rid of prohibition of marijuana in the United States and had to set a legal age for it based on the science, would we set it at the tobacco age of 18 or would we set it at the alcohol age of 21?
Right now, all the research would essentially suggest that 18 is a reasonable cutoff. I'm apprehensive about Americans trying to grow accustomed to that.
Yeah. Like,
you know, the alcohol model is something that we're a little more familiar with, and we may get more traction with that. If you really look at some of the brain development literature, it seems like alcohol probably shouldn't be legal till around age 24. But,
oh,
you know, you can imagine trying to get that law passed.
Mm.
So if you know, science were the lone guide, that would be the situation. But right now, the predominant studies on cannabis suggest that 18 wouldn't be, you know, this giant disaster.
Hmm. Well, you know, if we got rid of federal prohibition, the states could come up with their own ages. Maybe some would go 18, some 21, and maybe some would just keep prohibition as it is. It's certainly something we ought to try, I would say.
I'm open to that idea as well, but I'm sure that's no surprise.
Well, Dr. Mitch Earlywine, thanks again for joining us for Cannabis Science and giving us the real research here. And again, if folks want to get a hold of Dr. Earlywine and ask some questions, the address is 420research@gmail.com. Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks again.
Okay, I'll talk to you next week, and thanks so much. Have a good holiday.
Bye now.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our Daily Audio Stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Today we continue a week of somewhat alternative musical choices with The Funnies. I'd tell you more about The Funnies, but the Google will only give me information on comic strips. They used to have a website at thefunnies.info, but it seems to have disappeared. If anyone out there knows more about The Funnies, let me know in the comments. What I do know is this tune is from the album Masters of the Universe, which wins me over right there.
by the power of Grayskull.
The tune is called Spelunking in the Ganja, and if you don't know, spelunking is cave exploring. So I imagine this tune playing as a soundtrack to a long dolly shot through the canopy of an enormous cannabis garden, buds so thick and leaves so broad, the lights from above flicker through like lasers, piercing the lush sea of green in the frame. Well, this is The Funnies and Spelunking in the Ganja.
Thank you. 76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORMA. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORMAL, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
For a while now here on the Daily Audio Stash, we've been following the story of San Diego and San Bernardino counties in California and their reluctance to accept the will of the people that medical marijuana is a legal treatment in the state of California. They're opposing it in all sorts of ways, and joining us now to talk about the latest incident in this ongoing opposition is Aaron Smith, who's the director of the California Operations for the Marijuana Policy Project. And Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Russ.
So this latest kerfuffle here is with San Bernardino County. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what has happened and how they're taking this fight all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, that's just it. We don't know exactly what's happened. We do know that the county has filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court along with San Diego to continue their heartless challenge against the medical marijuana laws. But we don't know when they decided to do so. We don't know how they decided to do so as far as the Board of Supervisors is concerned, because they were very secretive about the decision that was made. And California has an open meetings law referred to as the Ralph Brown Act, which requires governmental bodies, the state all the way down to the local city councils and counties, to notify the public of their decisions that are made in private. In the case of a lawsuit, they do have the ability to vote and decide, you know, how to carry out the litigation in private, but they do have to come out and publicly announce the decision afterwards, and they did not do that back in August when they decided to take this to the state Supreme Court. They didn't make the announcement. And then now we're hearing that they've decided to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they, of course, didn't announce that either. We don't know when they made that decision.
And this is their ongoing court battle where they believe the federal controlled substances laws mean they don't have to obey the laws of California. Is that about right?
Exactly. And this is an extremely unpopular lawsuit. There's every time that this comes up in San Bernardino, there's, you know, dozens of patients and citizens lined up pleading with the Board of Supervisors and asking them to just follow state law, to not continue wasting tax dollars on this lawsuit. And they've ignored the will of the voters every time, and in spite of the fact that they've continually lost at every turn, not one judge has sided with San Bernardino or San Diego in the three different courts that this has been through. And we're not worried that the Supreme Court's going to take this case up, but I think that it's important that the county, stand up and say, hey, we've made this unpopular decision, so that they'll be held accountable for it.
Absolutely. And this is all about their idea of the federal law somehow preventing them from issuing ID cards, right?
Yeah, it's completely absurd. I mean, there's no federal law against issuing ID cards, and the sheriffs there have actually went on record recently that, you know, they're being sued by a local patient who wants to get an ID card for not issuing the cards. And when the sheriff was quoted in the newspaper about that lawsuit, they said that they're actually training their deputies not to accept cards issued from any of the surrounding counties in the area. Meaning that they're arresting everybody, patient or not, they're just arresting everybody for marijuana, and based on this idea that marijuana is a violation of federal law. But the interesting thing is I can't find one instance where the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department cited anybody with a violation of federal law. They continually apply the state health and safety code violation for marijuana possession or cultivation, which clearly these patients are exempt from under state law. So if I don't understand if they're having to enforce federal law, why aren't they citing these folks with federal violations?
It is a conundrum.
That's a rhetorical question.
Well, and the other thing, too, is I know that California, like all the states around here these days, are facing all sorts of budget deficits and cutting back on education and even letting some prisoners go free early because of the budget crunch and the prison overcrowding. Do you guys have any estimate on how much money, how much taxpayer money San Bernardino has wasted on this tilting at windmills activity?
Well, a local activist down there got that information back before they filed the petition for the U.S. Supreme Court, and they were saying not including a whole bunch of staff time. They of course gave him the runaround, but they gave him a ballpark figure of about $30,000, which is that's a low level salary of somebody whose job has already been on the chopping block, and And who knows how much money is being spent arresting people who aren't violating state law just to run them through the court system and eventually let them go. I mean, that's probably well more. I'm certain this is costing us a lot more money, and it's just completely insane that they would even consider using local tax dollars in that manner.
So San Bernardino County went and made this decision to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in private and then violated or appears to have violated this Brown Act for open meetings. What sort of mechanisms are there to hold them to account for that violation of the open meetings law?
Well, certainly local residents can file suit in civil court over this. And I can't say whether or not I know anybody is doing that at this point, but it's certainly an option that's on the table for local folks. So, and then again, there's the local taxpayers having to pay for the mistakes of the county's leaders on this.
It's an amazing story that keeps going through all sorts of interesting twists and turns. After the U.S. Supreme Court decides to not hear this case, as is predicted, what do you foresee San Bernardino or San Diego going forward with after that? What will they have left?
Well, they won't have anything left at that point. They will undoubtedly have to begin issuing these ID cards. San Bernardino is already being sued in a separate lawsuit for not issuing the cards, and we'll see how that turns out in the coming months. And I that's it. Once they go to the U.S. Supreme Court, that's the Supreme Court of the nation.
So, yeah.
We look forward to this finally being resolved, so that patients won't be terrorized down there. I mean, this is they're doing this as political posturing, but anybody who knows a medical marijuana patient who has to live in San Bernardino knows that they're living in fear, because the law enforcement down there is quite possibly the worst in the state, and they're publicly ignoring a 12-year-old state law.
Yeah, it's crazy the amount of madness that the prohibitionists will bring out in fighting against what the people want. It's amazing every time I have to report on this story. Hey, Aaron Smith is the California Policy Director for Marijuana Policy Project. You can find out more about them at mpp.org, where I'm sure there'll be all sorts of information on this story. And Aaron, we'll be back in touch the next time something happens down there in California, and we hope all the best here with this lawsuit not being heard.
All right. Thanks, Russ. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. for everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with a reminder for some programming notes about the cannabis community coming up on the mainstream media. Tomorrow, Thursday, on CNBC is the documentary Marijuana Inc., a look at the billion-dollar marijuana industry in America. That's Thursday on the cable channel CNBC. Check your listings for the time. And on Friday on NBC, the Dateline show, check out the Rachel Morningstar Hoffman story. They've got a one-hour story with some new information in that story as well. So check that out. Dateline NBC on your local NBC station at 10 p.m. Eastern time. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us for the podcast. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and interviews you can use for the cannabis community. Until next time, take care of each other, tokers.